opened, and in our show, the day the Union opened, and in 1928 this is. And that continued ever since with a steady program of art exhibitions, art lectures, competitive shows, and on and on. Well, now I better pause and let you tell me if this is enough on college days to show my entry into the Union field.
I'd be interested in knowing something about the origins of the Union idea and the Union idea here in Wisconsin.
This, of course, is now 75 years after the first major pronouncement in favor of a union was made. So, and of course, as indicated by the previous discussion, I didn't come until 1920. So, how accurately I can recall some of these circumstances, I suppose, is dubious. But there is ample documentation of it in our own archives, which could be used to verify anything that I say or to amend it. But in my reading of the history of the Union prior to my own arrival in 1920, the first mention of a union for University of Wisconsin occurred in President Van Hise's inaugural address in 1904. That's why I say it all started 75 years ago.
I see.
This year. And that address has been published in full. And in it, two or three pages are devoted to really a very eloquent appeal for a gathering place for students and families where they would learn informally from each other and where students would learn from each other and exchange ideas. And while I can't quote his exact wording, it was to the effect that nothing is more important to the student in his later life than the ability to get along with other people. And for this and for his best learning, he needs continuing daily association with his fellow students and with the faculty, and that this has been going forward at the unions in Oxford and Cambridge since the early 19th century. And to those unions, especially Oxford and Cambridge, Britain owes the cultivation of its national leadership in government, politics, and in professions. Because the coursework and the laboratory can do just so much for a student. But if we are to make leaders and men, and note the use of the word men, and men of character, as well as scholars, we should do as much as we can to emulate what Oxford and Cambridge have done for the sons of England. And note the word sons again. Of course, we all know now that at the turn of the century, the women had not yet come on the campus in numbers, and higher education, college education generally, was conceived as something primarily for men. There was a time in the 19th century when women were discouraged from attending Wisconsin
Yes.
You know, the story of Gretchen Chadwin.
That's right.
His unwillingness to have women enroll and so on. Well, this was a very venturesome and original idea to be coming in 1904 at the University of Wisconsin, because at that time there were only two unions in existence in this United States, each United States, at Houston Hall, University of Pennsylvania, and at Harvard. And they were men's clubs, men's social clubs primarily. Well, Van Hise was quite familiar with the British education and had apparently learned much about the Oxford and Cambridge unions and saw in them a model for what might happen to fill the void, as he saw it, outside the classroom at Wisconsin.
The void you seem to have been describing earlier.
Exactly. And this appeal didn't exactly fall on deaf ears. Original and innovative and spectacular as it was for the time, because in 1907 the Men's Union Board was founded. The members of that first board, and I have this from one of the members of that year who kept in touch with us and with me over the years, he was not all that aware of Van Hise's desire to create a union, but I think it got through to him and others by osmosis somehow, and I don't know what the somehow was.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure what the somehow was, because
Leonard Stevenson, the chap I'm talking about, was a member of Iron Cross, the senior honor society for men, and he and the other members of the society were kept in close touch with President Van Hise and university problems, university needs, because the Iron Cross Society was itself founded and devoted to the idea of service to the university. And Professor Frank Sharp, of the philosophy department, was a kind of a go-between between President Van Hise and the Iron Cross Society. And there came the time when Van Hise recognized that the new YMCA building, which had recently been built on this site where the Union parking area is now,
next to the Armory Gym,
two or three, something like that, it was falling upon very hard times. It was very strongly religious oriented, and religious tracts were handed out to and the one who came in the building. It was also a dormitory house, about 105 men. And it just was not appealing to the student, the populace, because of an excess of religious fervor. And so very few men rented the rooms, which was their represented their major source of potential income. So it was about to go bankrupt, and what to do about it. And Van Hise, conferring with Professor Sharp, asked him to see if the Iron Cross leadership, student leadership, had any suggestions on what might be done. Well, according to Stevenson's story, and this also is in letters in our archives, he went to a Michigan-Wisconsin football game at Ann Arbor in 1906 and saw there a modest little building called a Union Building, and which had just been created and for the purpose of housing student offices and meetings and a social get-together place, again, for men, and thought to himself, well, maybe this is an answer for the YMCA to become a general men's center instead of a religious headquarters. So coming back and talking it out with the other Iron Cross men of his year, they devised the idea of leasing the main floor, which was a floor consisting of lounges and some meeting facilities and so on, as a union headquarters to be operated by the men's union board, and with the men's union paying rental for that space, and with the men's union working to develop a new student attitude toward the YMCA by enlisting the support of students, and I'm referring again to men, generally, in living in the YMCA because of the whole change of atmosphere and approach.
One question I have. Before this, had the union group had no headquarters?
No headquarters of any kind. There was no union board at this time. It was an Iron Cross Society proposal that there be a union board.
I see.
Be a union board like Michigan, with a headquarters in the main floor of the YMCA.
I see.
And so in 1907, and this, you see, is 3 years after Van Hise's appeal for a union, which Stevenson said he somehow hadn't heard about, but maybe they didn't emphasize that, they didn't want it, and maybe Sharp and Van Hise didn't want them to feel they were errand boys to that extent, President Van Hise's own idea. But it came out naturally that if Michigan can do it, why can't we? So they formed the men's union board, and Stevenson became vice president of it and was the moving spirit. And there's his pictures off in the corner picture. He is literally the founder of the student founder of what we call the union, although it was in the beginning a men's union, following again the Oxford-Cambridge tradition, which was exclusively, those universities were exclusively for men, as you know, as was Harvard, as was the Houston Hall, Pennsylvania. And they were thinking particularly of a club-like center. They weren't all that aware of Oxford and Cambridge and their very great emphasis on debate and discussion. This had not got through to Iron Cross boys, I don't believe, at that time. Well, they took over in the YMCA main floor, and they installed bitter tables. They brought in daily newspapers and established a reading room. They moved all the athletic trophies from the gym over and featured photos of Wisconsin football and other athletic teams. And they set up a stand for the sale of candies and cigars and so on. And it, through that leadership and with that kind of facilities and with a program of social evenings, or smokers as they called them, they were called smokers for freshmen, either in the YMCA main lounge or over in the gym, adjacent gymnasium, the old red gym, to get students acquainted with each other and so on. This apparently all worked, and they persuaded some well-known, popular students to take rooms in the Y, and other students said, well, if it's good enough for them, it's all right for me too, and so I'll live there too. And the Y was indeed rehabilitated financially and saved. And this went on from 1907 to, well, I've forgotten the exact date, but I think it's something like 1912 or 13, 14, when the YMCA, now on its feet and with a resurgence of moral values, decided that it was evil to be selling cigars in a YMCA building and playing pool, and so they kicked the union out. They wanted the lease terminated, and it was terminated.
That's gratitude for you.
And so at that point, the union headquarters moved next door into a private residence that sat here where the Union Dining Wing now is. And it housed the Daily Cardinal, and the Badger, and the Octopus Humor Magazine, and Union Board offices, and the Harsfoot Club, and the Literary Magazine. And it had one or two small committee meeting rooms and one pool table. And when I came in 1920, this is what the union building was. It was so labeled, the Wisconsin Union. Well, the union board had not ceased its activity because of its cutoff of relations with the YMCA. In fact, they were expanding all through. They had, for example, an all-university exposition, which is something like the present engineering exposition that lasted for a week. And every department of the university was invited to set up exhibits and booths in the Red Gym and in the gym annex, and showing what they did and how they did it, with moving parts in the case of departments that dealt with machinery or agriculture and so on. And any other visible evidence of what a department was doing was displayed, numbers of publications, and this was all partly to get the legislature to come down and see what the university was doing. See, the union then, as now, was on the track of trying to win support for their university, which is a little strange in these days when we think of students mainly as protesters and as adversaries to the university administration and the faculty. Not so in the teens, in the 20s. Students energetically went all out to support the university wherever they could, because it was their university. They wanted it to succeed. You're proud of it. So the All-University Exposition was a great thing. Thousands of visitors came in, special invitations, as I say, to the legislature. Then they invented, or at least adopted, what maybe someone else invented, and that was the grid graph, as a way of reporting what was happening at out-of-town football games while the game was going on.
Well, would you explain what that is?
This was a translucent glass screen, maybe 6-7 feet high and 15-18 feet long, with a gridiron painted on it with all the 10-yard stripes, and then behind it a chap with a flashlight would follow the progress of the ball according to telegraphic reports that were being received on a ticker in the back room.
How ingenious!
And see, this was before the days of radio. Radio hadn't been invented yet. And so these reports would come in that Wisconsin's on the opponent's 40-yard line and has to punt. So and the punt is received at the goal line, and then the punt would be shown by a flashing flashlight until it hit the goal line, and then it would, a solid light would come back to say the 18-yard line, which is as far as the opponent ran, and then they had another kind of flash for a pass, and so on. And so there'd be an audience of maybe 2,000 people who paid 25 cents each to attend the grid graph, and there'd be an announcer who would announce the play as it came off the ticker tape, came off the telegraph ticker, while the guy with the flashlight showed the progress of the ball up and down the field. And the cheerleaders were there, and there'd be a band playing in the intermission, and the whole works. Well, this was all designed to raise money to add to the fund to build the union.
Uh-huh.
And it was in the same era of the teens that they invented the Union Vaudeville, again to raise money for the Union Building Fund. And then they started a series of dances at Lathrop Hall, Lathrop Parlors, you know, on the main floor, what is now, still a kind of a lounge setup, but it was cleared every Friday and Saturday night for a dance, and Union Board dances through the winter at Lathrop Hall Parlors, where the place to go. When it came to be late spring, they'd go to, they'd take one of the Lake Monona boats and go over to Esther Beach. You know where Esther Beach is?
No,
on
I guess I don't.
On the other side of Lake Monona. It was a kind of a dance hall resort on the south shore of Lake Monona. And everybody would wrap themselves up, get on this launch, and 8:30, and get over about 9 o'clock or 9:15, dance, and then start leaving about 11:30. They had to get the girls back in before 12:15 or 12:30. While this whole series of dance efforts were for the purpose of adding to the fund to build the union, which was going to have a ballroom in it, and. Now that had appeal. And then they brought in occasional traveling shows at the old Fuller Opera House. I've mentioned, I think, Union Vaudeville.
That was
held at the old Fuller Opera House. And occasional shows and concerts. And we're still talking about the teens. And the war came, and things pretty much fell apart
Most of the men had to leave the campus, go to war. And but when they came back, there was a very interesting and critical expansion of their performing arts program in terms of the creation of the Union Concert Series in 1919. Charles Mills, head of the music school, had tried bringing in outside artists for concerts in Music Hall and never could get more than a handful of students over there. And he had seen some of the results of the Union Board's efforts in staging things on the campus and in the old floor upper house. So he said, wouldn't the Union Board like to take over the concert program? And they did. And it was an immediate success because students were saying, it's worth going to a classical concert. Come on and go. And they promoted it like everything. And they'd hold the concerts in the gym, maybe get 1,500, 2,000 people out for a concert. And this went on through the 20s and is still going on. As you know, the Union Concert Series is the oldest continually existing program that the Union has, and it's one of the best in the country still at a college. And again, the proceeds went to the Union Building Fund, and each year the proceeds were turned over to the Union Building Fund. And having had this experience with organizing and presenting concerts, again, students were aware of the need for a concert hall, to wit, our theater, which didn't come in 1928, so when the first units of the building opened, the concerts were held in the Great Hall, the ballroom. The switch was made right away to the Great Hall, which was acoustically much better. And in the case of a major symphony or a notable artist like Paderewski or Rachmaninoff, he held the stock with it. So there was this whole series of efforts on the part of students via the Men's Union Board prior to the 1920s to build the fund to create a new center. Concurrently with this, Van Hise was at work too. He did follow up. He did try to get the legislature to provide the funds to build the building.
And I was wondering about that.
Got an appropriation passed, and then it was rescinded because some body at the legislature prevailed and said that we should be using state funds only to create classroom and laboratory facilities. So this was about 1914 or 15 that fell apart, although the legislature did give the site that this building sits on. Well, we're up to about 1920. Do you want to pause for a minute?
You've suggested that there was a turning point that came following the end of World War I. You want to discuss that?
Yes, it was indeed a turning point in the fundraising and general development of the for the Union project. And it came about for several key reasons. One was, of course, that there was now a broadly based interest in creating a war memorial at the university in memory of the men and women who had served, who had died in the war, former students of the university. University, and of course all those others who had served in the war. So the natural question was, what kind of a war memorial? By 1919, President Van Hees had died, so that he was not a continuing leader, of course, of the Union project. But Dean Goodnight, who was now the Dean of Men, saw in the Union two possibilities that were of importance, and one of them was that it could indeed be thought of as a war memorial project. The second motivation I think he had, from all I learned later, because I wasn't there in 1919, he was deeply concerned about the morale of the student body after the war. He was himself a strict disciplinarian and one of high moral standards, and was concerned about the whole nature of what student life would be like with the campus flooded with returning war veterans. And as the saying goes, he, and perhaps some others too, but particularly Dean Goodnight, was interested in having attractions that kept students on the campus and away from what were called the course attractions of the city. This was in the days, of course, of alma mater, the alma mater concept of the university's role, namely a protector of students, a foster mother who would see to it that students had what they needed, and that their behavior was somewhat supervised and even controlled. So an underlying motivation on the part of Dean, as I understand it, was to get a campus-centered student life as opposed to dispersal of students looking for entertainment and relaxation and funny business off the campus. Well, there was, of course, a growing realization that the kinds of fundraising that the Union Board itself could do, the kinds I've already mentioned, the Union Vaudeville and the dances and the grid graph and so on, would never accomplish the volume of funds needed to construct a union of any substantial dimensions. So what happened literally was joining of a felt need for a campus social and dining and recreation center with the now very persuasive emotional appeal represented by a desire to create a suitable war memorial. And these two elements in the picture were joined to create a new goal, namely a memorial union, a war memorial union. And this was not untypical throughout the country. At the same time, many other universities, particularly two in the Middle West, as with Purdue and Indiana and numbers of others, were headed in the same direction, namely to create memorial unions, with the thought that this was the most appropriate kind of memorial because it gave service to the young people who attended the university in a kind of recognition of the service that their predecessors had given to the country during the war. In short, a living memorial. Well, this was, as I say, in 1918-1919, and I believe it was Dean Goodnight more than anyone else who proposed that we now set forth to raise funds for a memorial union on a broad public gift basis. This was not easily accepted as a way of going ahead with the union project, because still at this time probably most regents, administrators, didn't have all that keen an understanding of what a union might mean for the university. But the president of the regents, Walter Kohler Sr., who was head of the Kohler plumbing firm in Kohler, Wisconsin, got the message. And I think it was because Kohler himself had established for his employees at the Kohler plant what he called the American Club. It was a very considerable physical building that provided for off-hour recreation for his employees, for dining, for games, for social get-togethers. And so when the union was proposed as a kind of club building for social and dining and service purposes, he, from his own experience at Kohler, I think understood what was intended and what meant by this. And I got this impression myself when later on when I came on the union staff as a fundraiser, helping in the fundraising, visited Kohler and talked with Walter Kohler. So Walter Kohler, as president of the Regents, carried great influence, and it was he who was instrumental in forwarding the project in 1918-19, and doing it by creating a Memorial Union Building Committee, as it was called at that time, a group of prominent alumni, some faculty members, some students, to set forth on a general fundraising campaign for a memorial union. This in itself was unprecedented in university history.
How do you mean?
In that the union campaign for funds became the first general approach to the public seeking funds that the university had ever undertaken. And it was hard going, very, very, very difficult.
Dean Goodnight himself was asked to be halftime, the campaign director. He was released from his duties as Dean of Students and director of the summer session, halftime.
Had he been on the union board prior to this?
Had Dean Goodnight?
Yes.
No. Dean Goodnight had been a professor in the German department until I think around 1913 or 14. And if you think back, that the war was with Germany, and that anyone with a German emphasis, even a teacher of German, was not all that favorably regarded. And the teaching of German itself diminished, and diminished rapidly. And I believe, as I heard the story, with the teaching of German declining, or maybe out entirely, so far as I know, Dean Goodnight was recruited to be a dean of students. And if my memory is correct, that he was either the first or one of the first deans of students.
Now, his concern with the union
was a concern with the nature of student life and the nature of student behavior, and his problems of student discipline and the assertion of standards in student behavior and so on. And he wanted to see the union come about as an answer to the problems of student life, including provisions of physical facilities for non-fraternity students, non-sorority students, that would give the so-called independents, or barbs, a social outlet. How far he emphasized that, I'm not just sure, because this was before I came. But at any rate, proved out, as you might guess, that halftime on a nationwide fundraising campaign, and with the distractions and requirements of two other major administrative jobs, didn't fit very well. And so he had to give it up shortly, maybe after 6 months or thereabouts. And a successor was chosen to be campaign director in the person of Professor Edward Gardner, Ned Gardner, as he was familiarly known.
Gardner was attracted to the project, as he later told me, because of his own experience with students in out-of-class informal association with himself and other faculty members. With O.J. Campbell, the head of the English department, and Gardner was in the English department, though his specialty was teaching in commerce, business letter writing. Gardner helped to organize what was called the Stranglers, a group of English majors who came to his house periodically, once a week or fortnight, sat around the fireplace and read their poetry to each other, or their essays. And he was enormously impressed by what students could do on their own outside the classroom because of internal self-motivation, and that the learning experience here was was superb. And so the idea of a center where students could follow their own inclinations in what they created, what they led, what they learned was of enormous appeal to him, and was one of the things that prompted him to accept the campaign to rectorship. The other thing that was influential was that as a teacher of freshman English, early on in the middle teens, having Van Hise's inaugural address appealing for a union in mind, every semester he assigned to his freshman class an essay on a union and what was a union and what could it do and so on. So he got this flood of themes back from students with their notions of what a union was all about. And so 5, 6, 7 years later, when he was asked to be campaign director, he suddenly realized that this was the project he'd been assigning freshmen to write themes about these early years.
What a wonderful idea.
And so he accepted the assignment, took leave from the university, went on the payroll of the Memorial Union Building Committee as campaign director. Now, the Memorial Union Building Committee itself, as Kohler, President of the Regents, appointed it, consisted of very prominent alumni, several former presidents of the Alumni Association, some top-name industrialists in the state, some well-known professional people, and some key faculty people. It was a very strong and influential group of men.
Were there any students on this?
There were two or three students. In particular, the president and or other members of the men's union board. But the focus of the campaign in those earliest years was fundraising among alumni, because they thought that's where the money was. It didn't really occur strongly to them that students who were known to be not the top economic group in our society, many working their way through, it didn't apparently occur to them that there was much potential in going to students other than let student organizations do what they could do to add to funds, like proceeds from union board events, like the profits from junior prom, and like senior class gifts as the class left the campus, and so on.
What they had been doing up to then, in other words.
Very much the same pattern. This now is in the very early 20s. So, Gardner set forth to raise funds from alumni, and this meant travel across the country to any city where there was supposed to be a nucleus of Wisconsin alumni. And the problem was the one I mentioned in an earlier chapter of this interview. Who were the alumni? How did you find them? There were no address lists. There were only indications that so-and-so, an alumnus, did live in Denver or in Oshkosh and so on. and probably were others. So Gardner would go into a city and look up one, two, three or more alumni that whose names had been given him, and ask them who else lives here that went to the University of Wisconsin. And 2 or 3 days would be spent looking through the telephone directory and conferring with friends of the key people he first made contact with, to assemble a group of alumni at a luncheon or a dinner so that Gardner could tell the story of what was proposed as a memorial union at the campus. Well, this was all greeted with somewhat cool reception, because alumni had never been asked to give anything personally to the university before. And the typical response was, why should I? The university is supported by taxes, is it not? And I pay my taxes. Why don't they just get this building out of the state legislature through tax money, including mine? So he had to fight this indifference throughout his tenure as campaign director.
Well, it's a good question. Why didn't they?
Why didn't they
what? Why didn't the university
provide? Why didn't they what?
Why did not the university provide funds?
Well, as I mentioned in our
description of Van Hise's efforts, he did go to the legislature.
He did get approval of, I think it was
$200,000 or $300,000 to build a union in about 1914 or 13, thereabouts. And the
bill was passed, but it was quickly rescinded
because other legislators
coming in the next session of the legislature felt strongly that state tax money should be used only for mm-hmm. instructional buildings.
And they didn't try again.
And so Van Hise tried, and at first succeeded, mm-hmm. and then the support was withdrawn by the legislature. So this left, as Walter Kohler Sr. saw it, only one other avenue, and that was to go for private mm-hmm. contributions. Walter Kohler Sr., by the way, later became governor of the state, as mm-hmm. you probably know. Well, Gardner
and the committee focused the campaign, therefore, a good deal on
benefits to the person who made a contribution, instead of to
counter this notion that tax money ought to do this. Why should I?
Well, why should I? The answer was, if you give $100, you become a life member of the Memorial Union Building Association, and this will entitle you to a discount on hotel guest room when you revisit the campus. It will be an open sesame to all sorts of other
advantages and privileges. The union will be your home away from home when you come back from 4 football games and reunions and so on. And so the early brochures composed by Gardner and developed by him, and he was quite an eloquent writer,
an emotional writer, it emphasized become a member, a life member of the Memorial Union. And there were slogans that went with it. The cover of the main campaign brochure read, "Build a Home for Wisconsin Spirit," for example. It was an appeal also to loyalty and spirit, which was a common thread in the 20s. Student spirit at the football games, cheering sections, our university, run the ball clear down the field, boys. This was all part and parcel of the mood of the time, but there was no focus or home for it. So Gardner's theme was build a home for this spirit that it may flourish and develop into something even greater. Well, one of the now known defects in this whole fundraising campaign was the emphasis on a life membership at $100, because it kind of set a level of giving that was unfortunate. Many men could have given $500 or $5,000 or more, assumed they had discharged their obligation when they did what the campaign called for, and that was become a life member at $100. So there were no large gifts forthcoming, and any fundraiser of recent decades knows that public fundraising project depends first of all and most of all upon initial very large gifts. There were a few, mainly by the Kohler family itself. The Kohlers, not only Walter Kohler himself, but his wife and his brother and his sisters, all were persuaded to give substantial sums, like $5,000, for example, which was big money, fairly big money in the 20s. But on the other hand, despite the weakness this represented in raising dollars, it represented a great strength in terms of a broadly based alumni interest in the union and support for it, because it involved not just hundreds but ultimately thousands of alumni in a personal identification with the union as a member. They belonged to it. They hadn't just made a gift and gone away. It wasn't like giving a gift to the library and you never knew what became of it, or and there was no feedback or no personal identification with it. In this case, the alumnus received a life membership card, he received a gold lapel button with a W on it, which in those days many wore. And proudly, because it signified in their social group, I'm an alumnus of the University of Wisconsin, and so on. And remember, these were the days when people wore their Phi Beta Kappa keys and their fraternity keys on their best watch chains and so on. So this was not all that unusual. In fact, it had a good deal of appeal, and we even in my regime of the 20s and on into the 30s, people would write in and say, "I've lost my life membership, but can't get another one," and so on. So it had its merits, too, in terms of a broadly based alumni interest in what this union was and how it was functioning, and how it might succeed. And it's still true that whenever I attend a class reunion, anybody's class reunion, or any alumni gathering and introduced to somebody, they say, "Oh, you're Porter Butts. I got a life membership card in the union with your name on it. I want to show it to you." And they haul it out, and sure enough, there's this dog-eared 20, 30, 40-year-old card. And they often ask, "Can I get a replacement? It's wearing out." During World War II, we would get telling letters. I remember one in particular from a Navy man, Wisconsin alum, saying our ship sank off Anvil Beach at Italy, and I got ashore, but my Union Life membership card is all soaked and I can't use it. Could you possibly send me another, because as I go through the war and meet up with the Wisconsin people, I want to prove to them that I am an alumnus of the University of Wisconsin, and I want to come back to Wisconsin as soon as this is all over and have a beer on the Union Terrace. So there was an emotional involvement through the whole life membership approach that was very salutary and has continued to be a great source of strength for this union, and which does not characterize any other union anywhere, because while some others raised funds, as Michigan did, for example, through life memberships following the war, they let it drop after the fundraising campaign was over. But in our case, we offer a life membership to every student leaving the university at a reduced student rate.
You still do?
Still do.
What is the reduced rate for students?
And about one out of every 8 or 10 students, just upon receiving a